Translation and Interpretation, the first talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 5, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right, I hope I can get through all the stuff I have here today, and I hope that it's understandable. We're actually going to do philosophy instead of Bible this morning, but let me explain what we're doing. I'd like to begin a series teaching through the book of Romans. I've done the book of Romans several times in various contexts, but I've never done it here at Reformation Fellowship. But I'm going to be approaching it in a slightly different way, a way that I've never approached it before. I want to use the book of Romans as sort of a springboard for examining in depth Pauline theology, the theology of Paul, which I think is the same thing as New Testament theology. So I'll take my time, and we'll spend some time developing concepts and ideas, and I will spend some time arguing for one way of interpreting Paul rather than another way of interpreting Paul, just whatever seems appropriate. And I don't even know what that is yet. I'll be winging it, figuring out from week to week what is the best thing to tackle. The other thing I'm doing is I'm fine-tuning a translation of the book of Romans that I have been working on for a while. But I'm doing two things. I'm actually reconstructing the Greek text as I go and translating the book of Romans as I go. And I will be teaching from my translation as far as I have finished it. So as things go, we'll have this little orientation here this morning. Next week is Easter, so it's not a full-length message. And we will start the book of Romans, the series of Romans, the week after Easter. Before the week after Easter, I'm going to post online somehow, somewhere, and I'll let you know how and where, my translation and my Greek text, the Greek text that I'm translating. And you can download it, print it, whatever you want to do. Let me just warn you before you print it, though, it is a work in progress, so I'm going to be constantly changing it and reposting it to the internet. So,
I just wondered what you meant by reconstructing the Greek text. Can you address that?
Sure, yeah. Well, basically what I mean is that I have two volumes. One is called the Greek text based on majority manuscript, something like that. And then you have what is more typically accepted as the Greek text that put out by the United Bible Society, for example, or a Nestle Aland is another classical text that you would use in seminary that's the Greek text. What they have done is they've culled through thousands of manuscripts and have decided what the original text must have been based on the readings of those thousands of manuscripts that don't always read verbatim. There sometimes are differences between the manuscripts. So the question is, given these different manuscripts, which manuscript represents what Paul actually wrote? So reconstructing the Greek text is making the decision, the manuscript that Paul actually wrote represents what Paul actually wrote. That's what I mean by that. And I don't know if we'll get into this. Maybe we'll spend some time on this. But I'm not altogether confident that the philosophy used in reconstructing the standard Greek text, United Bible Society and so forth, is really the most appropriate philosophy for reconstructing a text. So my philosophy weights the majority text more strongly than the standard Greek text that you have. So I pay attention to what most of the manuscripts have and give that more weight than has been done in the Greek manuscripts in the Greek text that you have and in the English translations based on those. So I was looking at something last night, for example, where a whole clause is left out of the New American Standard that I think belongs there. And it's in the majority of manuscripts, but because the New American Standard is based on the standard Greek editions, they have not translated it because it's not in those standard Greek editions. I forgot to check, but I would imagine it's in the King James, but it's not in the New American Standard. So I don't agree with the philosophy of the one volume that deals with the majority text, nor do I agree with the philosophy of the other one. Mine is a different approach altogether, and I want to reconstruct the text based on that philosophy. And perhaps we can talk about that somewhere along the line. So that'll be online, and then my translation is in progress. I will be constantly changing, constantly tweaking it as I get more time to work on it. But that's what I'm going to be referring to. Now, the most important reason for referring to that is that I have not only retranslated it, I have completely reformatted it. The formatting that we have, I don't exactly know why it takes the form that it does. I suspect it had to do with technology. I suspect it had to do with whether they were writing on papyrus and scrolls and that kind of thing. And it was purely a practical matter of where scrolls ended and stuff like that, that dictates a lot of the ways our Bibles gets divided. But there really is no reason from the interpretation of the book of Romans why Romans should be divided up the way it is into chapters and verses. So you'll find that in my edition, for example, I will end a whole portion of the book of Romans right smack dab in the middle of a verse in the classical traditional delineation organization of the book. So a section will end halfway through the verse, and then a whole new section will end in the second half of the verse. Things like that. So my reference system is to divide it into paragraphs and then number each paragraph and number each sentence within the paragraph. So that's my reference system. 23.2 is paragraph 23, sentence 2. And then I have also included divisions that try to reveal what I think is the rhetorical structure of the letter. What are the major portions of the letter, and then where are the sections within each portion, and so on. So I want to be using that so that that work is already done and in front of you visually, and I won't have to talk about that all the time. The translation I'm working on now is a more literal and less free than some of the translations I have used in the past. I think it's easier to teach from a more literal translation. The more literal it is, the more closely it's sticking to the actual wording of the Greek text, and the closer it sticks to the wording of the Greek text, the easier it is for you to see that I really am interpreting the text and not making stuff up. Well, I don't know. Maybe. Okay, so that's what's happening. I want to start this morning by making a few comments just on translation and kind of make a case for why it's not absolutely crazy for me to be doing what I'm doing, giving you my own translation. I mean, why don't I just stick with those English translations that are out there? The first point to see is that it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that the English translations you have in all leather-bound sobriety and seriousness, that those Bibles did not descend from heaven. Now, I mean, obviously we all know that, but the psycho-emotional impact of having the weight of everybody using it, an established publishing company printing it leather-bound with gold leaf and whatever else we do to make it seem serious. In the final analysis, it's just some dudes translating Greek. In the final analysis, they aren't doing anything that I haven't done in offering you my translation. It's just ordinary people. Granted, they have experience and training and knowledge that most of us don't have, but in the final analysis, they are just people making decisions. They're not apostles. They're not inspired. They're not prophets. So there's nothing sacrosanct about our English translations. I think that's the first thing to remind ourselves of. I know we all know that, but it's so easy that just emotionally, using somebody else's translation, you just feel like you are treading on ground that you shouldn't tread on. I mean, shouldn't we use, I joke about it, but shouldn't we use a real Bible? As if any other translation is not really the Bible. So it's important to remind ourselves that all those English translations that we're using were just translated by ordinary people. Because of that, our English translations are interpretations of the Bible. And as interpretations of the Bible, and having worked with interpreting for a while now, I understand very clearly how absolutely powerful the pre-understanding that you bring to the Bible is in what you see there as you're interpreting and translating it. You can't, in fact, it wouldn't really make any sense. Why would you interpret the Bible to be saying something different from what you know is true? You know that it's true already. I mean, that's your pre-understanding. You come at the Bible thinking that you have some grasp of what the faith is all about, who God is, who Jesus is, who Paul is, what Paul's concerned about, what Paul's trying to convince you of. You already have an understanding of all that, some of which comes from careful study, some of which you just absorbed from culture, absorbed from your environment. But you know it's true, and it's real, and it's reality to you. Well, why would you not interpret and translate the Bible in a way that conforms to and is in keeping with what you know is true? So it's a very powerful force shaping what I give you in a translation. Now, that's not only true of the people who shaped your Bibles, who translated your Bibles, but it's true of my translation. My translation is going to be offered to you based on what I have become convinced through a variety of different means is the teaching of the gospel by Jesus and the apostles. So mine is no better, but neither is it more misleading than any other translation in that regard, in that it's a reflection of my lifetime of thinking about this stuff. So our English translations are made by people making judgments to the extent that they've made judgments that rightly reflect what Paul intended when he wrote the book of Romans, then the translation is valid, legitimate, good, helpful. To the extent that it doesn't capture and reflect what Paul intended, to that extent, it's not really a legitimate, valid translation and needs to be rejected. That's true of the Bibles you have in your lap. It's true of the translation that I'm going to offer you. Nothing guarantees a priori the validity of our standard English translations. Nothing will guarantee a priori the validity of the translation that I'm giving to you. Nothing can. The other thing to keep in mind is that most of our standard translations, unlike the translation that I'm offering you, is done by a committee. The New American Standard is done by a committee. New International Version, I think, is done by a committee. Most of the modern translations coming out are worked out by scholars coming together and negotiating how we're going to word this. That has its advantages, but it has incredible disadvantages, because the minute you form a committee, you have political considerations determining how to render the text. I'm not interested in the politics of the church. I'm interested in trying to grasp as best I can the intent of Paul and conveying that to you in my English translation. So I'm not going to be looking at over my shoulder as to whether I'm going to get in trouble by this, unlike the committees that form most of our translations. Doesn't make me right, just makes me apolitical. So every Bible teacher has confronted this. No Bible teacher is not in the business of retranslating the translations we have. But there's two ways you can do that. One way to do that is to avoid the obvious and explicit impression that I'm retranslating the Bible by trying to stick very closely to one translation, English translation or another, but I explain the meaning of the translation differently than even perhaps the translators intended. Say, here's what it says. They, you know, you could take it to mean this, but rather if you look at the Greek text, obviously we need to go this other way instead. And so you can stay within the boundaries of the wording of the Greek text, but you fill it with new content, content that is informed by your study of the Greek text. Perfectly legitimate way to do it. It has the distinct disadvantage, however, that you have to work within the constraints of the wording that's been given to you in your standard English translation. So I'm choosing a second method, and that is to produce my own translation. That makes it clear that it's my judgment that is going into my reading of the Greek text. So it doesn't allow me to give you the impression that, look, I'm just the translator made the decisions about what it says. I'm just telling you what it means. Well, that's not true. I mean, we're always making a judgment about what the text means, whether we're using a translation or not. It has the added advantage, however, that it's not confined to the bounds set by somebody else's wordings, but it has the distinct disadvantage that it's easier for you to doubt the legitimacy of my translation. And that's where my earlier comments come in. I know it's easier to doubt the legitimacy of my translation, but my contention would be that doubting is fine, but it's important to extend that same doubting to all your other English translations. All of our English translations need to be received critically in the final analysis. Did the translator get it right? Did the translator get it wrong? I know we don't like that. I know that makes us feel uncomfortable. It looks like we're on shaky ground. When someone just gives me a Bible and says it's fixed and you can't mess with it, it feels like I'm on firm ground. But the truth of the matter is that's not what we have. Whether we like it or not, God chose the Greek language for the biblical authors to write the New Testament in. And unless and until you know Greek, you're not on firm ground in the sense that you want. So as long as someone has translated it for me, then there's the risk that I'm working with a text that isn't exactly conveying what the author intended. So am I, the obvious question then is, am I qualified to translate the New Testament? That's a good question. But we need to ask the same question of the other English translators. Are they qualified? Do we know they're qualified because they're anonymous? Does that make you qualified? Are they qualified because our subculture considers these translations valid and safe, whereas everybody knows that you need to hold Jacks in suspect? Is it because they're familiar? Or is it because they come with all this cultural acceptance pass through the institutions that give it, make it reality for us? All of those things have a psychological impact on us, and I think we just need to be honest about the extent to which my emotional response is colored by those things rather than any real sound judgment. I'm saying that I'm confident of my experience, my qualifications, and my competence to do this. I wouldn't be offering you this translation if I didn't think that was true. I've been studying the New Testament in Greek for 35 years. I've learned a lot. I've changed my mind a lot. I've gone through several paradigm shifts in my understanding of what the New Testament is saying. And I think it's all because I'm really intent and focused on trying to understand what Paul meant, not what the church has told us, but what Paul meant and what Jesus meant in the New Testament. But my saying so and my confidence doesn't make it right. And that's one of the nice things about it being my translation. It becomes all the more easier for you to do what you should do, and that is go, yeah, but is he right? But is he conveying the text the way it was really intended? And that's the question that should always be in the forefront of our mind in any time we deal with the Bible, no matter who's dealing with it. So much for translation. I want to make a few comments on interpretation, and the reason I'm doing this is because I'm going to, throughout the course of the book of Romans, I'm going to challenge some assumptions that are pretty deeply embedded in evangelical culture, particularly in the Reformed tradition, about how to understand the book of Romans. So it's important to come to terms with how is Jack thinking about this? How is he coming to his conclusions? What philosophy is he using as he approaches the interpretation of the book? So I want to make a few comments on that, and then hopefully I can get through all this and then leave time for questions. First of all, I think it's crucial to understand what's going on in language. If, as Paul sat to write down the book of Romans, Paul begins by grasping something. And there's something out here. It's intangible. It's inarticulate. It's tacit. You're not really conscious of what it is you're grasping, but you're just grasping it. And in the process of But you want to convey that in a way that other people can grasp the same thing that Paul is grasping. Some fact about God, some fact about God's grace, some fact about human sinfulness, some argument that he wants to make about why the gospel is true in a way that Pharisaical theology is not. There's an understanding, a cognition of reality that Paul has tacitly grasped. And I'm not describing anything that doesn't go on with you every day. Whenever you open your mouth, you already know what you want to say before you say it, or else you couldn't say it. Right? I mean, that's the important thing that I'm saying, is that you tacitly know what you want to say before you can articulate what you say. Now, there are some comic exceptions to this, but typically, that's how human beings operate. That's what Paul is doing when he's writing the letter to the Romans. He, out of his wealth of experience, teaching by the Spirit of God, clarity that's come to him by the Spirit of God, there's this thing that he owns as his own in his head. When he sits down to write or speak, but to sit down to write or speak, you then continually are referencing that which you know, and you're seeking to put into language, put into words, that thing that you know so that your reader can, through your words, somehow work their way back to grasp what you grasp, to know what you know and hold in their mind what you are holding in your mind. That's language. That's communication. It's admittedly, and I again, if we're honest with ourselves, we need to recognize what a mysterious, amazing, awesome process language is. How can I get something in my head into your head without any connection in between? That's the magic of words, the magic of language, that I'm able to articulate in, be put into some wording, some signs, some symbols, something that makes you able, if I have done my job at all competently, it makes you able to see what I see, to grasp what I grasp, to know what I know. Well, the magic of language is at work in the New Testament here. But what that means then is when I, as an interpreter, come to the text of, let's say, Romans, I become, at first, preoccupied with the parts, a word here, a word there. What does this word mean? What does that word mean? What is this strange grammar, this strange syntax? He put the phrases together in this particular way. Why did he do that? What can I conclude? What can I judge from the way he's used his language and what this language conventionally and typically means? And notice part of why language works is because we learn to expect what words mean from the way people always use it. So it's the conventions of the social conventions of language use that I'm depending upon. I'm expecting you to use your language the way I've heard everyone else using their language for the most part. So I begin from the conventions of language meaning and language usage. I begin there to try to piece together and construct what is this thing Paul understands that he wants me to understand, piecing it together from the parts. I don't know the whole that is informing what Paul is trying to say. I only have all of his parts. He's giving me the whole, but he's giving the whole to me constructed out of a string of parts that he's given me. So I have to start with those parts and reconstruct the whole. Well, how do I do that? Well, I have to start by taking those parts, reconstructing the parts, and trying to work back up to the whole as best I can. But I'm going to come to some kind of initial sense, unformed, not altogether satisfying sense of what Paul is getting at. I will have eliminated a lot of options. You know, he's not talking about ice cream. He's not talking about furniture. Has something to do with God. You know, I mean, I'm going to have some kind of general sense of what he's getting at. The more I work with the parts, it's going to be narrower and narrower. I'll begin to know more specifically what he's saying about God or sin or mankind or grace. But as I begin to work with trying to get this whole picture, there's going to be a tension between the whole that I'm putting together and some of these parts, this word and what it means, this syntax and what the significance of this syntax is. There's going to be a tension there. There's going to be a gap there. So I'm going to have to go back and look at the parts again and see, well, am I misunderstanding that part? Should I look at that part differently? Should I put it together differently? And I might decide, no, I don't think so. I mean, I'm looking at, this is what the conventions of the language would predict. So I think this is really going on. So I must not have my understanding of the whole right. So I go back to my understanding of the whole and I adjust it and I modify it. And now I can make sense out of the language here, but now I have some tension with some other parts of the language. So something's not working. So I have to go back and look at those parts again. Examine again, have I understood them rightly? Should I understand them differently? Can I understand them differently? And maybe I'll decide, yeah, I've misunderstood what he meant by that word. And so I begin to learn something new about the Greek language. I guess this word can be used in this way. And I guess this syntax can be taken this way because that seems to be what he's doing with it here. And I'm going to go back and forth in a kind of dialectic, in a dynamic dialectic, going back and forth between the elements, the parts of the language, and my grasp of what his meaning, his whole meaning is. Until finally, something is going to click. And I will go, oh, I get it. Here's what he's saying. And it will typically be tacit. It will just be in a kind of intuitive flash. Oh, okay, this has to be what he's saying. I may not even be in a position yet to defend or even articulate or really eloquently, forcefully, compellingly persuade you that that's what it's saying. I don't start there, but all of a sudden, through the course of paying attention to the details of the language and trying to see what they're pointing to, all of a sudden, you see it. It's not unlike Wittgenstein talked about a famous drawing, line drawing, that if you looked at it in one way, it's an old woman. If you look at it another way, it's a young woman. And it's really, if you're looking for an old woman, you see an old woman, and it's really difficult to see the young woman. And someone has to say, well, look, I mean, can you see that might be the nose and the ear? And even if they start pointing out to you, you don't see it immediately. But the minute you see it, then you cannot not see it. Well, that's what interpretation is like. When you see what Paul is saying, then all the pieces make sense. Oh, yeah, this is the eye, this is the ear, this is the nose, this is the hair, this is a scarf. Then you can explain how the lying jarring is working once you get it. But if you don't get it, you can't see it, and you can't explain to somebody else. That's what's going on in biblical interpretation. There has to be that paradigm shift, what they call it, a gestalt shift. There has to be a gestalt shift where you see what whole it is that Paul is trying to convey to you in this paragraph or this argument. That's what you're looking for, is that gestalt shift. Once you understand that, and to the extent that you can begin to articulate it explicitly, you're really done with biblical interpretation per se. If you know what Paul is saying, you know what Paul is saying. Now, as someone who's translating the text, I have to go further than that. Once I have grasped what he's saying, then I need to go through the process of going, now, where's the ear? Where's the nose? Where's the scarf? And be able to reproduce that in English. And that's what translation is trying to do. So what all that implies is that logically, the meaning of each part of a biblical text is logically determined by the whole, the gestalt of the meaning that Paul was trying to convey with that language. It doesn't work the other way around. Meaning is not derived from word meaning and language. Word meaning and language is derived from the author's intent. That's crucial to understand that. If you don't understand that, you won't really be able to accurately understand your Bible. But in the order of discovery, in the order of how you uncover the meaning of a text, you have to start with the parts and work up toward the whole. But logically, it's the whole that determines the meaning of the parts, not the other way around. The meaning of the parts do not determine the meaning of the whole. So what that means then is interpreting a sentence in the Bible is not a mechanical process. It's not akin to solving an algebra problem or manipulating a statement in formal logic. It's more like recognizing someone's voice or recognizing when you have the right kind of flavoring spices in a dish that you're cooking. Did I make a fool out of myself? Or making wine, you know, or picking out the wood that you want to use to make a violin or a guitar. I mean, you can't use a mechanical process for any of that stuff. You just need to know what you know when you know it. You need to see what you need to see when you see it. You need to taste what you taste when you taste it, and know when it's right and know when it's wrong. Biblical interpretation is an art, not a process of deduction, a formal deduction. It's seeing, it's getting it, it's grasping it. It's not proving it. I've had many, many fun Christmas Eves putting together toys for children from those directions that were translated from Chinese. And it's a great experience because for someone like me, I am an imbecile when it comes to machinery and mechanics and stuff like that. I just marvel and envy those people who look at the directions, throw them away, and then put the toy together. My first, you know, something inside of me goes, can you do that? Isn't there a law against that? I mean, can you do that? Well, I can't do that. I just don't have the mind to be able to understand how things work together mechanically and physically. But for those of you who do know that, do know how to do that, it's amazing how, if you were to watch someone like me, how completely impossible it is to put things together by directions. You know, that they think they're being so clear. You know, put the dooley gig in the dooley bob. Why? is it supposed to hold something? Does it look good? Without having any comprehension of the end product that I'm shooting for, I don't know. I don't even know what the direction means. Put it in? Which side? How far in? None of that stuff is spelled out for you. You geniuses know instinctively and intuitively how far and where and from what direction and in what angle. I don't know any of that stuff. And so it's torture to try to put together any of those things from directions. Bible study is exactly like that. You don't do Bible study by following directions. Even though, I dare say, anyone who takes exegesis seriously in seminaries these days is likely to be teaching a mechanical process, a deductive process. Here's how you do biblical exegesis. You look at this word, you decide what it means using these steps, using these methods, and once you've decided what that means using these methods, you go to this word and use these methods to decide what this word means. You understand the relationship to each other this way. Consider these five things and there you go. But the result is just like the toys that I build. You get all kinds of things wrong. You followed all the rules. You did everything you were supposed to do, but you didn't know where you were headed. You didn't know what it was supposed to look like on the other end. And if you don't know what it's supposed to look like on the other end, you're going to really do some really crazy things in your taking the Greek language. So the critical thing to notice is that some of the differences between my interpretation and more standard interpretation is going to be based on my conviction that biblical interpretation is an art, not a logical system of deduction, and not a mechanical process, whereas there are all kinds of people out there who are going to defend their interpretations based on some mechanical process. But you didn't put the dooley bob in the dooley gig, or the other way around, in the right, according to the rules. And I'm going to go, yeah, I didn't, because look what a funny product I would have got if I had done that. So there are four things to keep in mind then, given that that's my understanding of how language works and that's my understanding of how interpretation works. There are four things we need to keep in mind, I think. Exactly the same words can mean very different things. And I mean exactly the same words. Exactly the same sentence can mean something radically different depending upon the context. I didn't see it, but someone told me once about a Saturday Night Live skit that was based on the statement, you can't put too much water in a nuclear reactor. And the dilemma that the nuclear reactor operator was faced with is he didn't know what that meant. Did it mean you must be careful not to put too much water in a nuclear reactor or it's going to explode? Or does it mean no matter how much water you put in a nuclear reactor, it can't be and won't be too much? Well, it made all the difference in the world, you know, which one it meant. But the language, the statement alone, was not sufficient for someone to know what it meant if they didn't know other stuff, if they didn't have the right kind of background and knowledge to be able to interpret it. Well, the Bible is full of things like that. And that's why people get in so much trouble when they lift a sentence out of the Bible and say, well, here, the Bible says X. Yeah, but what does that mean? Well, it means X. But when we put it back in the context of the paragraph and of the letter, the book, the theology of the New Testament, the theology of the Bible, the minute you begin to provide more context for it, you recognize that it could mean very, very different things than it may seem and appear to mean if you just abstract it out of the Bible and take it by itself. because we're always going to supply a context. Whenever someone says X and the Bible says X, we're going to supply the context, and the context is going to be what we've got from the church tradition, from the church community that we come from. We know what's true, we know what's right, we know how to understand this, so that must mean what that must be what this means. We're going to run into several comments like that along the way in Romans. In reconstructing the text, I ran across a fascinating thing in Romans 4:19. There's a textual variant in 4:19 where some texts have the words not, and some texts leave the word not out. And the incredible thing is when I looked at it, it doesn't make any difference in what it means. I mean, if the not is there, it makes perfectly good sense in the context. If the not is not there, it makes perfectly good sense in the context. And the paragraph, indeed the sentence, means exactly the same thing either way. When we get there, I'll explain it to you. But there's no way you can put a minus sign in an algebra equation and not change the equation. You know, if you're talking about something mathematical and deductive and mechanical, putting a negation in there should make all the difference in the world. But we're dealing with language, and language is malleable enough and flexible enough and derives its meaning from the context in such a way that you make the appropriate adjustments, and the not ends up not being not. We'll look at that later. So you don't deduce or calculate the meaning of words. You just have to, in an intuitive flash, get what it is that they're saying. Other factors, obviously, let me back up. If you were to go to a seminary, and would anybody at a seminary say, you know, just pay attention to the word meanings and the syntax, don't pay any attention to anything else? No, they wouldn't say that. They'll talk about history and culture and geography and background and how important that is, and you got to know that stuff. And I was trying to think, okay, so what's the difference? What are they doing that's different than what I'm doing? They are looking at all that other study, background and so on, as guides to the meaning that's determined by the words in the text. That other information is useful and helpful in that it can guide you to grasp what the words mean, but it's the words that mean it, and the meaning is determined by what words are used. I'm saying something else by that. I'm saying the meaning is actually determined by those other factors, by geography and culture and history and theology and all that other stuff is actually part of what is informing the mind of the author who used those words to convey what he's conveying. So those things are actually determinative of the meaning of a text, not just helpful guides. They're actually logically determinant of it. Now, there's a danger, a little bit of a danger in what I'm saying. We have to remember that it takes training through experience to be able to tell the difference between an unartful false claim that I get what Paul is saying and a legitimate true claim that I get what Paul is saying. They're not the same thing. Let's take something else. If we're going to explore the degree to which our minds and our rationality operate tacitly, unconsciously, in a way that we can't even articulate and explain what it is we know, that's what I mean by tacit. One of the ways that you can recognize the tacit dimension to our knowledge is when we encounter people, for example. You encounter people, and every now and then you might have that experience of, don't trust that dude. And if someone were to come along and say, why, you'd have a very difficult time articulating why. You can't explain why. You have just taken in all kinds of information, all kinds of data, body language, tone of voice, all kinds of stuff that has created some kind, has led you to make some kind of judgment without even knowing that you've made a judgment. it's led you to make some kind of judgment that there's something funky here. You don't want to trust this guy. And is that legitimate? Absolutely. That's how the human mind works. That's intuition, a hunch. Hunches and intuitions are not infallible, but they are thoroughly rational and can be utterly competent, utterly useful to us. However, if you were to explain that to a freshman or sophomore in college, for example, and explore the tacit dimension of knowledge to someone, they could very easily go crazy with that. You know, knowledge is tacit, so therefore I can say all kinds of things and you can't prove me wrong because I don't have to be able to articulate why I think that. I just have to tell you that I feel this way, you know. I just have to tell you that I have this hunch. Well, that would be very immature and unartful of the person, because intuition takes experience, takes training, takes practice. And over time, you can hone your ability to intuitively know what it is that you know. In principle, intuitive experience is always rational. It's eminently rational. If it's not rational, then it's not intuition, it's just imagination. You're just making junk up. Well, the same thing can happen in Bible interpretation. I am utterly convinced that the goal of biblical interpretation is to have that intuitive flash where you get it, that's what you're going after in Bible interpretation. But if you are not responsible with that, then you're just going to imagine that you get it without actually getting it. And imagining that you get it is not the same thing as getting it. And it's important to recognize that. So immature people could do all kinds of damage with the tacit nature of biblical interpretation. So don't do damage. Yeah, you have to remember that the intuitive flash has to come at the end of painstaking, careful, articulate, conscious reasoning. You've wrestled with the text. You've looked at the grammar. You've looked at the vocabulary. You've gone to the lexicons. You've done word studies. You've pored over it for hours. And at the end of that painstaking, deliberate, articulate, explicit process, you get that flash. Oh, I get it. Here's what's going on. If someone comes along and reads it for the first time and gets it, don't think so. I'd be highly suspect that they're imagining that they're getting it. They're not really getting it. And even for an experienced exegete, there's a false experience of getting it. It's that both the benefit and the obstacle of our pre-understanding. Oftentimes what we get is my own paradigm for what the faith is. And it feels strong and it feels true because it matches what I already believe. And since it matches what I already believe, it impacts me in a way that seems really compellingly real and compellingly true to me. So I think I've got it. But I always have to recognize that intuitive flash is not an infallible indicator that I have it right. It's only that I'm having the experience of thinking right now, confident right now that I have it right. You'll find, and in fact I may bring into our discussion of Romans different thinkers, different authors who have wrestled with the book of Romans, and they are in significantly different places on certain issues. It's not that they lack experience. They're not making it up. They're not imagining it. They really do see it differently. What do we do with that? You are really going to see Romans differently than me sometimes. What are we going to do with that? We need to remember, when you have that kind of disagreement between two skilled interpreters, that each of them is looking at the text through lenses. And when I come to recognize that John Piper has different lenses than I do when he looks at the book of Romans, what are we going to do with the fact that there's a disagreement between us? Well, I need to have the humility to realize there's a strong possibility that the lenses that he's looking through the book of Romans through are actually clearer and less distorting than the lenses that I'm looking at it through. That's a distinct possibility. I would hope that someone like him would have the humility to recognize that maybe the lenses that I'm looking at the book of Romans through are clearer and less distorting than the lenses that he's looking at through. But ultimately, that's going to have to be a personal decision that you're going to have to make. Is people are offering me different lenses here. What am I going to embrace? What am I going to hold? What do I think is true? What do I think most consistently matches what Paul himself would say? And I'm sorry, but I can't take that decision away from you. You're all alone on that. You have to make that decision. Nobody can make that decision for you. And I don't think it's particularly responsible of us to hand that off to somebody else. We need to take it seriously enough that we think it through ourselves and decide for ourselves what makes the most sense to me. There's what I call the math problem fallacy. Oftentimes in dialogue and debate back and forth about what a text means, the deductive mechanical approach to biblical interpretation often embraces a fallacy that goes something like this. I must validate my interpretation of a text by showing, and by that I mean proving, by proving why the text can't mean what you're saying it means. So, and we often fall into this. I mean, if I'm going to go to John Piper, it's very tempting to go and say, well, let's go look at some text. I'm going to find a text where it's impossible for that text to mean what you say it means, and that's going to prove you wrong. Well, good luck with that. Alternative interpretations wouldn't be being proposed if they were obviously stupid and obviously invalid and obviously something that the text can't mean. I mean, with some exceptions. But by most skilled exegetes, they know what they're doing. They know how language works. They know their Bibles. They've thought about this stuff, and they have put it together in such a way that it makes sense to them that this verse could actually mean what they're saying that it means. I come along and I look at that verse and say, I don't think it means that. But my goal and my task is not to prove to them that it can't mean what they say it means. The goal and the task is for me to, if I want to persuade you, for example, is to get you to work with and look through the lenses that I'm looking at it through long enough that you recognize that the Bible is actually clearer that way. And that's all I can do. I can't do any more than that. Nor should, it's a unrealistic standard to put on anyone to say, you need to prove all the other interpretations wrong or you have no business offering your alternative. No, it doesn't work that way. All of our interpretations are probably viable, are plausible, are believable, are intelligent. All the alternatives are that. The question is, what did Paul mean? That's the issue. So we have to do more than make the case that it, for ourselves as interpreters, we need to not be satisfied to just come up with an interpretation that could be right. What we're looking for is the interpretation that was actually intended, that actually matches what was intended by Paul. Talking about conventions, we look at the conventions of language. That's a good place to start, a good standard to judge meaning by, as a place to start, but it's not the ultimate and inviolable standard. It's not that what the language has to mean in the light of the whole that I've grasped is much, should take precedence over what I think the language has to mean in the light of conventional usage. And there's several things to say about that. Take, for example, when people think that it's not the whole, but it's the conventions that should take precedence, they have real trouble any time you take language metaphorically. Unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you have no part with me. Eat means eat in the conventions of the language. Drink means drink in the conventions of the language. I mean, what kind of idiot are you? Don't you know what those words mean? And if I take them metaphorically, and if I suggest, well, it doesn't really mean that literally, then they think that you're straining the conventions of the language. Now, granted, they're more willing to allow you to do that because we're familiar with metaphorical use of language. But notice that what we're doing, we're saying the conventions of the language don't apply when we depart from the literal meaning and begin to be more and more metaphorical, then we're being innovative here. We're using the language in an uncharacteristic, unstandard, unconventional kind of way. So if language was defined by conventions, then metaphorical use of language would be impossible. I'm just going to argue that there are some things that wouldn't typically be considered metaphor, where we're going to have to recognize that the standard conventional use of the language is being used by Paul in a way, in an innovative kind of way. He's tweaking it. He's doing something with a little rhetorical flourish to say something that is not straightforwardly what the syntax and word meaning might suggest. And in doing that, the question is, can you do that, Jack? Well, it all boils down to which takes precedence, grasping the meaning of the paragraph and then understanding the way he's using his language in the light of that, or do you grasp the way he's using his language and make that inviolable? And you can't interpret it in a way that has Paul doing anything new or anything unusual or out of the ordinary. In the way we use our language, we frequently bend, violate, ignore, change, alter the conventions. It's always possible to communicate even though my use of the language is unconventional. The classic example of that is a foreign non-native speaker. A non-native speaker of English will be perfectly understandable even when they're being very unconventional, especially with prepositions. Non-native speakers have a horrible time with English prepositions. It's always the wrong preposition. How do I know it's wrong? Because I know exactly what they meant. We just don't say it that way. Right? Well, it didn't interfere with their conveying their meaning, though. The fact that they violated conventions didn't destroy their communication. It didn't destroy the meaning. It was just not the way we do it. So part of convention has an impact in determining or guiding us to what we mean, but part of our conventions are just stylistic. It's just habit. It's just the way we say it. And then finally, it's dangerous and even arrogant, I think, to assume that I have an adequate grasp on what the conventions of the New Testament Greek are. I mean, how would I know that? I'm not a native speaker of New Testament Greek. I'm spending the rest of my life learning the conventions of New Testament Greek. And in the very passage that I'm studying it, I may be on the threshold of learning something new about the boundaries of the conventions of the language. I don't know that ahead of time. All of our conventions were learned from context where we understood the whole first and then understood how the parts convey that whole. There wouldn't even be any knowledge of conventions if we hadn't done it that way. I'm saying, why would we put an end to the process of grasping the whole first and then understanding the language in the light of how that language conveys the whole? Quickly, two last points. People will often appeal to the natural meaning of a passage or the simple meaning of a passage. More often than not, whenever someone says this is the natural way to take it and insisting on that, what they're doing is insisting that you look at the Bible through the lenses of my theological assumptions. It's an attempt to disallow you from seeing it through any other set of assumptions, any other lenses but mine. There's a classic debate that's really funny. I mean, Luther's my hero, but this was not his best moment. He was in a debate with the Genevan reformer Zwingli, and they were debating the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, and Luther had a quasi-Roman Catholic view, and it wasn't exactly the Roman Catholic view, but he was insistent that the host in the Eucharist actually became the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. Zwingli had what I think is a much more commonsensical view is that the body and blood of Christ were simply signs and symbols. The bread and the wine were signs and symbols of the body and blood of Christ. But in that debate, Luther is known to have said, the text says, "This is my body," and "is" means "is." Well, what could be more natural, right? What could be more natural except that "is" means "is" in the context of a certain paradigm, in the context of a certain set of theological assumptions. It only naturally means what your paradigm makes it natural, in a way that your paradigm makes it natural to construe it. Peter gave us the example last week, Jesus saying to Peter, "Peter, you are Petros, Simon, you are Petros, and upon this Petra I will build my church." The fact that he goes from Petros to Petra, is that significant? Maybe, maybe not. It may be altogether insignificant, or it may have great significance, but whether or not it's significant has a lot to do with whether you already believe in Roman Catholic theology about the nature of ecclesiastical authority. If you accept their view of the Pope, there's no more natural way to take it than that he's talking about Peter and the authority of Peter. But if you don't believe in papal authority, there are plenty of other options. And it just so what seems natural to me in the way I take it, what's natural to me is a reflection of what I already believe. And that's got to be on the agenda of every one of us if we're going to be serious Bible teachers, is the discipline to be able to step outside of looking at the Bible through my set of lenses and considering the possibility of looking at it through somebody else's set of lenses. Not because I'm agreeing with them yet that they're right, but how am I ever going to know whether they're right until I look at it the way they look at it? So yeah, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to create the kind of imagination, the kind of discipline, and the kind of integrity that we're willing to take a look at the Bible from different angles through different lenses and judge it on that basis. So finally, what all this comes down to then in a way is that language doesn't have meaning in and of itself. Language is used by an author to convey his or her meaning. The meaning is that which is grasped by the mind of the author. He encodes that in language in hopes that he's done so competently and you'll be able to work back through that language to get what he gets. This is what the text means, though, this thing that he has in his head, not what's encoded in the linguistic elements and symbols on the page. So language doesn't mean, people mean, and they use language to convey that meaning. So all that's to say, I'm not going to be real impressed with the contention that a lot of people would make to some of the things I'm going to say in Romans, that sentence can't mean that, and come up with some verb tense or meaning of a preposition or something to tell me that it can't mean that. It's really rather bizarre to argue that a sentence can't mean something on the basis of understanding the grammar when that something is exactly what the author was seeking to convey. If I'm sitting down in front of you after a long journey, just packing the food in faster than you can serve it up, and I look up and I say, "I'm not very hungry." You're not, you don't sit there and say, "You can't mean that." That sentence can't mean that. I mean, that's exactly what I'm trying to convey, is that I'm hungry, and I say that I'm hungry by saying that I'm not, in a particular kind of way, in a particular context, and so on. I'm the one that determines what I mean, not the rules of the grammar and syntax that get strung together in an assertion or a sentence. That's no less true in the Bible than it is in everyday life. It's the author who wrote Romans, Paul, who determines what he meant there, not some contrived, inviolable rules of grammar and syntax that we pretend to know from several thousand years later about a language that we don't speak. And And so we have to just live with the text, live in the text, dwell in the text, ponder the text, wrestle with the text, until we finally grasp the mind of the author behind it. That's the task of biblical interpretation. That's the task that I hope I'm engaged in, and that's the task that has led to the conclusion so far, and I always reserve the right to change my mind, but the conclusions that I've reached so far about what's going on in the book of Romans. And I am more confident than ever that I'm really beginning to grasp what Paul is doing there, and so I'm looking forward to this series. Questions, comments?
I am not really an elephant. Do you know what I meant by that?
No.
Good. I agree a lot with what you're saying, Jack, and you know I love you dearly. But you chose, when you tried to convey the idea that you were hungry, use the word hungry, which had a range of ideas. In other words, I have to choose words right. that have some kind of connection to the phrase.
Right.
So you're not really saying that the words have no meaning at all. My selection has to be from a grouping, at least, that will give some logic or some reason to my phrase.
Yeah.
In other words, my phrase, you were sarcastic when you said you weren't really hungry. So the sarcasm chose words that related in some degree to the content.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember I said in the process we start from the parts that have been given to me. I have no other place to start but from the text and the language itself. Well, how do I start working with that language and that text? I assume basically conventional meanings to these things, which is your point. Yes, absolutely. I'm taking that for granted, that we would want to expect that the language is being used in the conventional way, because it would be fairly incompetent communication if it wasn't. I mean, how am I ever going to get it if you don't stay close enough to the conventions that the conventions are going to guide me toward your meaning? And I'm assuming that the author has known that and has communicated accordingly. The reason I'm harping on this is not because I'm wanting, you know, I don't want you to ignore what the words mean. What I want you to do is not see that as inviolable. Notice that language is always changing. It used to be that bad couldn't mean good, but now bad can mean good, right? I mean, that as people use language in a novel way, then over time people pick that up and it becomes part of the convention then of the language over time. But you can take one sentence one word in a sentence and give it a completely, radically unconventional meaning, but everything else around you lets you know what that means. Once it gets used that way enough, then it actually becomes part of the convention.
Thank you very much, Jack, for all that. I don't know if you want to do this now, but I'm thinking it would be helpful to talk about the role of the Holy Spirit in interpretation. Briefly, maybe.
Okay. Well, briefly, because we could say a lot about that, but briefly, the Holy Spirit doesn't tell me what to think. What tells me what to think is the teaching of Jesus, the rational conveying of ideas by Jesus and the apostles and the prophets and so on. I know what to think by listening to their ideas, and if I grant authority to them, then I know that they are explaining the truth to me. It's not the Spirit's role to whisper in my ear and say, believe this. The role of the Spirit is, we've got a problem. We have the challenge, the intellectually challenging task of taking this book written in ancient language in an ancient culture at the other side of history, and from my vantage point, understanding what it is that these guys are saying. That's intellectually challenging in and of itself. But I have the added challenge that it's speaking the truth, and I don't really much like the truth. I don't want to hear the truth. I am a rebel against God who is hardened and calloused against it, doing everything I can to evade the truth. That problem is what gets solved by the Spirit of God, is the Spirit of God gets me under his thumb and says, wait a minute, stick with the truth. believe the truth and live your life in the light of the truth, and supernaturally transforms my heart and my spirit. We'll look at this in significant passages in Romans, where this is what he's talking about. Significantly transforms my inside, my spirit, such that I'm no longer a rebel against truth, but I'm someone who's eager and hungry to know the truth and embrace the truth. That, I think that's the role of the Spirit. Otherwise, the brightest people in the world who can meet that intellectual challenge just fine will never make it to the truth. They don't want the truth.
You've been talking about how hard it is to understand what it is that the Bible's saying. Does that mean that it's dangerous for one of us to sit with our NASB and by ourselves without a bunch of commentaries and learning Greek and all this time that you're talking about, try and understand what the Bible's saying?
Whether that's dangerous or not depends on who you are. If you're wanting to find some new way of thinking about God, then it's dangerous. If you are wanting to know God, it's not dangerous at all. It's what you should be doing. Now, there's a problem, and that is that if you just sit down with your NASV and start reading it, you're going to try to make sense out of it, right? I mean, unless you're just doing it for a half hour to get your Bible reading in, you're going to try to make sense of it. Your mind craves to understand it. And because you crave to understand it, you're going to go to the resources available to understand it. Well, what are those resources? What you've been taught, what your tradition tells you, what you learned in Sunday school, what the pastor said, and so on. And then it's only as dangerous as that tradition is. But you don't have to know Greek to understand the Bible. I mean, as much as I'm going to quibble and quarrel with certain aspects of English translations, still, the quibbles and the quarrels that I have with them are on finer points for the most part. So if you just read and read and read and seek to understand the whole, you may not without Greek be able to understand the whole of a sentence, but can you understand the whole of the work of the letter out of it just reading the English? I think so. But you have to think about it. It's not going to be like reading the story in the newspaper where it's just made so clear and so simple that it's going to be effortless to understand it. You're going to have to ponder it. Why is he asking yourself questions? Why is he saying this here? What's at stake? What question is he answering? Those kinds of things. And by doing that, even with your New American Standard, you should be able to make tremendous progress in that end. I mean, my early work in Romans, I didn't know Greek, but I did know something about language and how language worked, and so I wasn't faked out by the fact that, well, this word is there, and so I'm stuck with that. Well, I could ask the question, wonder if they translated that right, and I wonder if I have exactly the right nuance on that.
I appreciate your kind of dipping into the cultural aspects of this. I personally think from listening to these comments and so on that one of the keys to really understanding the Bible is really understanding the culture which it comes from. And one of the examples, I mean, how many people understand the nature of sheep and goats? I mean, that to me is, if you're not experiencing and living with them, so to speak, you don't get that type of understanding why Jesus would call us sheep. Mm-hmm. And I've had the fortune to actually live in another culture and visit other cultures, and the language aspect is just... And if I could speak a little bit to your translation, the more I've looked at, like, quote, academic text and so on, and translations and so on, even in those, I just see blaring errors. And a lot of it is just, I think, related to culture. They just do not understand the culture with which they're translating.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, being a musician, I can have kind of a better grasp of understanding the organic aspect of language. And to some degree, academic texts are very much like music that is written specifically with theoretical rules.
Right.
I mean, it's perfect, but it just...
But you have to transcend the rules
yeah.
to actually try to capture the aesthetic thing yeah. that you think they were after.
Yeah. Well, no, that's not what I was
oh.
heading toward.
I thought that was a pretty brilliant idea.
What I was trying to point out is that rules are really only a way of helping you understand.
Yeah.
And what I see in music, there are some theorists that wrote these symphonies, and they sound so mechanical and so dry. Whereas someone like Mussorgsky, I don't know, he's a Russian composer, his music is considered to be just really sloppy, and but it's just so organic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's so gripping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in language you get that too.
One of the criticisms of the doctrine of inerrancy that I've heard is that John in the book of Revelation has bad grammar. Another example of that. I've got to let you go. I'll be glad to entertain some of your questions after this. There is going to be a meeting following... as soon as we can get it going, for any of you who have already decided that you'd like to lead discussion groups in connection with our study in Romans, or if you simply don't know and have been contemplating whether you want to or not, I'll give you a better picture of what I'm thinking and what my vision is for this and might help you decide whether you want to be a leader. And then we'll deal with some of the logistics of getting that organized. So if you could, it shouldn't be a long meeting, but if you wouldn't mind, those of you who are... have some interest in that, sticking around for a little while longer. Thank you.